Our scripture reading this morning is from the Gospel of Luke, chapter 15, verses 1 and 2 and 11 through 32. It begins in your church Bibles on page 806. Now the tax collectors and sinners were all drawing near to hear him, and the Pharisees and the scribes grumbled, saying, "This man receives sinners and eats with them." And he said, "There was a man who had two sons, and the younger of them said to his father, 'Father, give me the share of property that is coming to me.' And he divided his property between them. Not many days later, the younger son gathered all he had and took a journey into a far country, and there he squandered his property in reckless living. And when he had spent everything, a severe famine arose in that country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to one of the citizens of that country, who sent him into his fields to feed his pigs. And he was longing to be fed with the pods that the pigs ate, and no one gave him anything. But when he came to himself, he said, 'How many of my father's hired servants have more than enough bread, but I perish here with hunger? I will arise and go to my father, and I will say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Treat me as one of your hired servants.' And he arose and came to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and felt compassion and ran and embraced him and kissed him. And the son said to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son.' But the father said to his servants, 'Bring quickly the best robe and put it on him, and put a ring on his hand and shoes on his feet, and bring the fattened calf and kill it, and let us eat and celebrate. For this my son was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found.' And they began to celebrate. Now his older son was in the field, and as he came and drew near to the house, he heard music and dancing. And he called one of the servants and asked what these things meant. And he said to him, 'Your brother has come, and your father has killed the fattened calf because he has received him back safe and sound.' But he was angry and refused to go in. His father came out and entreated him, but he answered his father, 'Look, these many years I have served you, and I have never disobeyed your command, yet you never gave me a young goat that I might celebrate with my friend. But when this son of yours came, who has devoured your property with prostitutes, you killed the fattened calf for him.' And he said to him, 'Son, you are always with me, and all that is mine is yours. It was fitting to celebrate and be glad. For this your brother was dead and is alive. He was lost and is found.'" Please be seated.
Good morning. My name is Jordan Maroon. I had the privilege to grow up at Stony Point and then recently was able to move my family back to Richmond and to our church, so this is very exciting. I work for an organization called Needle's Eye Ministries, which is a ministry to Metro Richmond and to Marketplace men and women, helping you live out your faith in the workplace. So it's a privilege to work there and to be with you this morning. A man was walking along the Golden Gate Bridge one day when he saw a woman looking very lonely standing on the edge of the bridge. So he ran up to her to tell her that God loves her, and a tear came to her eye. And so he said, "Are you a Christian, maybe? Are you a Jew, a Hindu, what?" And she said, "I'm a Christian." And he said, "Me too, small world, Protestant or Catholic?" And she said, "Protestant." "Me too, what denomination?" "Baptist." "Me too, Northern Baptist or Southern Baptist?" "Northern Baptist," she said. "Me too, Northern Conservative Baptist or Northern Liberal Baptist?" "Northern Conservative Baptist." "That's amazing, me too, Northern Conservative Fundamentalist Baptist or Northern Conservative Reform Baptist?" "Northern Conservative Fundamentalist Baptist," she said. "Remarkable, Northern Conservative Fundamentalist Baptist Great Lakes Region or Northern Conservative Fundamentalist Baptist Eastern Region?" She said, "Northern Conservative Fundamentalist Baptist Great Lakes Region." "A miracle," he said. "Northern Conservative Fundamentalist Baptist Great Lakes Region Council of 1879 or Northern Conservative Fundamentalist Baptist Great Lakes Region Council of 1912. She replied, "Northern Conservative Fundamentalist Baptist Great Lakes Region Council of 1912. And he shouted, "Die, heretic," and pushed her over the rail. That was not where you were thinking that story was going. In John 13, in verse 35, Jesus says, "By this, all people will know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another." But if we listen to the conversations happening between Christians and churches and denominations, face-to-face or online, for even a few minutes, we find that there's not a lot of love out there. We're much quicker to condemn and to judge, to divide between the good people, the bad people, the good Christians, and the bad Christians. And so this story, this very famous parable that Jesus tells that has been meaningful to me for most of my life, I started to find as I studied it and began to understand more of the cultural context in the last few years that there is so much here that I never saw before, because I always just viewed it as, well, this is Jesus telling us about how the Father loves us, which he is. That is the primary thing he's doing. But he's also telling us a lot about how we ought to view ourselves and view each other and treat one another. And so if you're familiar with this story, what I want to do is challenge you to see it with new eyes, because the audience that Jesus is talking to, the Pharisees and the scribes, they would have known all of the traditions, all of the customs, all of the law that was in place. That was their job, to know those things. And so in the way that Jesus tells this story, the details that he includes and the details that he leaves out would have hit them right in the face, because they were so familiar with them. And what Jesus does, it's really interesting. He reveals the three main characters each in a unique way. So he shows us the younger son by the questions that he asks, and he reveals the father by what the father does, and then the older son is revealed by what he doesn't do. And that's how we're going to look at this text as we walk our way through it. So first, the younger son. The younger son is revealed by what he asks in verse 12. He says, "Father, give me the share of property that is coming to me." Well, when do you get your inheritance? Well, we know that that happens when the father dies. So what he's saying is, give it to me now, as in, I wish you would just hurry up and kick the bucket and get out of the way so I could get my stuff. Well, often for me, when I would read this passage, that's just where my understanding of this would stop. But then I've done more research and I've come to understand that in first century Israel, what would happen is, as the father aged, the sons would gain what was called the legal right of possession, which means technically it's their stuff. It's not the father's anymore. But they wouldn't get the legal right of disposition, which means the father is still the one that had the right to enact trade, to buy or sell. He got to do with the property what he wanted, because he was still the father, he was still the patriarch, but it was their stuff. And that's why in verse 31, he's going to say to his son, "All that is mine is yours. You have the legal right of possession. This is your stuff." But a few verses earlier, he's going to have the right, the father's going to have the right to kill the fattened calf, which was a prized possession, because he has the legal right of disposition. And that's not just a legal, I don't know, minutia to throw out there for you. This actually really changes our understanding of what's happening here. You see, the younger son already has the legal right of possession. It's technically his stuff, but it's not enough for him. He wants control. He doesn't trust his father to do with the property as he will. The natural way for him to ask this in Arabic and in Hebrew would be, "I want my inheritance," which is two words in those languages. It's a very simple thing, very normal request. But instead what he says is, "Give me the share of property that is coming to me." A more complicated request, six words. "I want my inheritance. Give me the share of property that is coming to me." And he's differentiating between inheritance and property. Well, why? Well, what normally comes with inheritance in that culture, a culture that's all about family and honor, is that when the father passes away, the sons, they get the property, they get the money and the stuff, but they also get the responsibility. And so it's their job, including this younger son, then to lead the family clan, to administer property, to solve disputes, to increase the family's reputation, to increase the family's wealth, to represent the family well. But that's what he doesn't want. He doesn't want his inheritance, he just wants his stuff. And it's interesting because even more so than it is for us today, in that culture, your inheritance wasn't primarily the dollar value that you would get or the property that you would get. It was primarily your placement within your family. That's where your social status came from. That's where your assurance of a marriage came from. That's where your security, your physical and emotional well-being came from, your reputation. And he's saying, "I want no part of that," which would have been really unimaginable, but even more than that, unpardonable. And so he's within his rights to ask for his stuff. I mean, he has the legal right to do that. He's not breaking the law, but he's breaking a number of customs. And more importantly, he's breaking fellowship with his father. He's breaking his father's heart. And then you have to ask yourself, well, how easily could the father liquefy enough assets to give his son one third? I mean, it's not like they can just cut him a check real quick, right? Their assets are tied up in houses and land and crops and property, in servants. You can't turn that into cash very quickly, especially in a culture that is all about bargaining and haggling. If you have to make a major sale very quickly in a bargaining culture, what happens? You get equal value? No, you take a huge loss because you got to make this happen. And so what's happened is this wealth and this property that is accumulated for generations in this family is taking a huge hit, all because of the impatience of the younger son. So if all he really cared about, if the most important thing to him was, I just want my money, if that's what mattered the most, he would do one of two things. He would either wait until his father dies, because then he'll get the full amount without any sort of depreciation because of a quick sale. Or he'll say to his dad, I want out, I don't want to be part of the family, but why don't you take your time selling this because I really want to get mine, right? But that's not what he cares about the most. What he really wants more than anything is independence. He doesn't trust his father to direct his life. And it seems that he thinks his father is some kind of killjoy, right? He's going to immediately go out and start partying. Later in the passage, his brother, the older brother, is at least going to accuse him of being with prostitutes. We don't know if that's true, but clearly he wants to live this very rebellious life, and he doesn't trust the father to let him have the fun that he wants. And we're like this with God quite a bit, I think, where we want his stuff, we're happy with his blessings, but we don't really trust him to be the one to direct them, to be in control, to give them to us when he wants to. If he would just make things work out in my timing, the way that I think would work, that would be great. You know, I often, like this younger son, have struggled to trust God with money, actually for many years, and even though he's provided for my family. But I often just think, and I was even thinking that this week as I was preparing this sermon, I was thinking, you know, if God would just drop a nice nest egg, a nice financial windfall into my bank account, then I'd be fine. He could just leave me alone. We'll be good, right? I want his blessings, but I don't really want to depend upon him. And that's what's going on with this son. So he hasn't broken the law, but he has broken relationship, and he has broken his father's heart. So what would we expect the father to do in response? I don't know what your dad would do, but what a first century Jewish dad would do would be, he would be expected to reject the son, to disown the son, to cut him off. Because who has all the authority in this relationship? Well, the father does. And who's in the right in this interaction? The father is. And who takes on all the pain and the humiliation? The father does. He grants his son freedom even to turn away, even to walk away from him. Because if he didn't, if he said, no, we're done here, their relationship's just over. They can't reconcile anymore. But by his suffering, by allowing himself to be humiliated, allowing himself to be mocked by his son, he makes it possible for the son to return one day. And what Jesus is doing is he is breaking all of our expectations of what fathers are like. All the expectations that we have, all the expectations that they would have had in that very patriarchal culture. And he's presenting to us this picture of a father that should alone shape how we understand God as our Heavenly Father. And that's hard. We could probably do a whole sermon on that. Some of us had great dads. Some of us had absentee dads, abusive dads, terrible dads, mediocre dads. I don't even say that lightly. I mean, I think that's really painful. But what Jesus is trying to say is when I tell you that God is your father, I'm saying he's like this. And by his suffering, he makes it possible for you to come back to him. So we start to see the younger son by what he asks, and we start to see the father by his response. But what about the older son? I mean, he's not even in this part of the passage. What is it that he's not doing? Well, you would imagine that it would take some time, even in a rush, to sell off all this property and all these crops and to liquefy the assets. And in fact, verse 13 tells us not many days later this happens. So not many days later, but a few days later. There's plenty of time for the older son to hear what happens. And in fact, Jesus tells us that the father divided his property between his two sons. So his older son would know that something's going on. And what would we expect him to do at that point? Well, I think that if it were you and your brother went to your dad and said, I wish you were dead and you would just give me my stuff and I could get out of here, you'd probably go talk to him. You'd probably yell at him or try to understand or just figure out what's going on. You'd probably go to your parents and make sure they're okay because that's a blow. And especially in the first century, because according to Jewish custom, even though the son has not broken the law, he's broken relationship, which means the father can't go talk to him. The father is prohibited from going and talking to his younger son before he leaves. And so the expectation is that on the father's behalf, the older son will go. And he'll plead with his brother, and he'll say, please don't leave. You know that Dad loves you. We're going to miss you. This is going to kill Mom. Come back. We're going to be praying for you. Please come back as fast as possible. But he doesn't do that. Today, in Western culture, when you're growing up, naturally, the two people in authority over you are your father and your mother, right? Well, in that culture, the two people in authority over you were your father and your older brother. And so his absence, his silence, as his younger brother is pushing away from the family and getting ready to leave, is very indicative of their broken relationship. There is something really wrong between these two brothers. And we're going to see later in the text that he is not happy when his younger brother comes back. He is bitter and judgmental and angry. It's possible that he's part of the reason why the younger brother leaves in the first place. It's possible that that enmity between them is a barrier to the younger brother returning to the father. Because we have to remember, the older brother in this story is a stand-in for these Pharisees and tax collectors, and the younger brother is a stand-in. Excuse me, I need to say that again. The older brother is a stand-in for the Pharisees and the scribes, the religious people, and the younger brother is a stand-in for the tax collectors and sinners. And so it's like Jesus is saying, Pharisees and scribes, your disdain and judgment of these tax collectors and sinners, that's a barrier to them coming back to me. And so he doesn't go and plead with his brother because of their relationship. But you know, even if they had a really bad relationship, you would still expect him to go for the sake of the father. Now, my brother, I have a younger brother, and he's a great guy. We have a great relationship. He treats my parents really well. They treat him great. But let's say we had a terrible relationship, and let's say he said some really awful things to my dad. And I was so furious with him, and I wanted nothing to do with him. I couldn't believe it. I still really love my dad. And so because I love my dad, and because it would be killing my dad that this happened and he can't go talk to my brother, I would go talk to him just because I love my dad. But he doesn't do it. Things are not just broken between the brothers. They're broken between the older brother and the father as well. He also, like the younger son, does not want to fulfill his family responsibilities. So who do we condemn like the Pharisees did? Who do we look down upon? Who do we convince ourselves that we have every right to ignore because they're sinful or bad or ignorant or different? Well, our father wants relationship with them. And so out of love for him, we ought to get over ourselves and how we feel so that we could go tell them how he feels. He wants relationship with them. It doesn't really matter how broken my relationship is with them or how bad I think of them. He loves them, and it is my responsibility as his son to go and tell them of that love. And if I don't do it, if you don't do it, what does that say about our relationship, not just with those folks, but with the Father, if we don't advocate on his behalf? So then Jesus turns us back to the younger son, and the younger son has another question he's going to ask here in a minute, because he's gone out and he's squandered all of his wealth in reckless living in verse 13. But then he doesn't go home, even though there's a famine. Well, why not? Well, I imagine there's a couple reasons. One of the reasons is he's probably humiliated. He just lost all this money. Maybe he can't bear to face his father after what he did. Maybe he's worried about what the village is going to do. We're going to talk about that in a moment. Or maybe, in addition to all that, maybe he can't bear to be indebted to his brother, because now all the property is his brother's. And if he goes back, he's going to have to live off of his brother's home, his land, and his good favor. So instead of going home, what he does is he gets this job feeding pigs, which in that culture, as a Jew who viewed pigs as unclean, that was about the most demeaning job you could possibly get. And he's desperate even to eat their food. And so finally, he's desperate enough, he's hungry enough, that he decides to go home. And notice what he says in verse 17. This is really key for us. He says, how many of my father's hired servants have more than enough bread, but I perish here with hunger? His motivation in going back isn't, oh, I really want to apologize to my dad, I really want to make things right. His motivation is, I'm hungry. And so his apology, Father, I've sinned against heaven and before you, I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Treat me as one of your hired servants. It's not a real apology. It's a means to an end. Maybe if I say that, I'll get to eat. He doesn't really want to be reconciled. And we do this to God as well, right? We come up with a bargain for God to make things right, where I don't really want to restore a relationship with God. I don't really want to apologize, but I kind of need that promotion. I need that relationship. I don't want to get caught. And so we make these deals with God, and then our confessions are just a means to an end. They're not a real attempt to be reconciled to the Father. Well, there's another first century Jewish custom that the Pharisees and scribes would have been well aware of, And that's this: when a Jewish boy lost the family inheritance among the Gentiles, and Jesus has told us the younger son went to a far country, so he went to the Gentiles. When a Jewish boy would lose his inheritance and then dare to return home, they would have a ceremony called the kezuzah, which is the cutting off ceremony. Okay, and in this ceremony, the community, among other things, would surround him. They would break a large pot right in front of them, and they would say, "He is cut off from his people." And so then they would have nothing to do with him. He would have no rights. He wouldn't belong in the community anymore. And the only way he could fix things would be to pay back the money. But the problem for this guy is that he doesn't have a trade. If he had a trade, if he had skills, if he was a craftsman, then when the famine hit, he could have gotten a better job than just feeding the pigs, right? But he doesn't have any skills. So he needs to go back to his dad, because nobody in the community is going to hire him, and he's cut off, and he needs to basically beg his dad to take him on as an employee, as a hired servant. So when he's thinking about his dad, that's what he's thinking about. He's thinking about, I need to eat, and I need to solve this problem of the lost money. I need to earn it back so I can fix things. But as we said, the problem, the main problem is not the lost money. It's the broken relationship. But that's not on his mind. And so Jesus' ultimate question for us and for the Pharisees and the scribes in this story is this son ultimately a servant or is he a son? And are you ultimately a servant or a son or daughter of God? Because you see, if he's a servant, then he can get a job, he can make money, he can pay off his debts. But if he's a son, that's not enough. That doesn't solve the relationship. But he doesn't understand that. He doesn't want to be a son. He doesn't understand what his father's really like. He's not asking for money. Excuse me, he's not asking for mercy. Did you notice that? He doesn't ask to be forgiven. He says, yeah, I was wrong, but let me fix it. Give me a job, I'll make it right. Do we live as if we're God's servants or as if we're his beloved children? Because that's what this guy's doing. So he's got his plan. And so in verse 20, he arose to come to his father. And as soon as he gets to the village, this cutting off ceremony is going to start. So they're going to, like I said, they're going to surround him. They're going to break the pot. He's going to be publicly shamed. Then they're going to take him to his father's house, and he'll have to wait on the steps for a while before his father comes out. And then his father's going to come out probably very angry, and then he'll make his little pitch, right, his little plea. So this is his brilliant plan. The best plan he came up with includes being horribly and publicly humiliated, being cut off from his community, and then working like a dog to try to make things right. And somehow, that is more appealing to him than asking for forgiveness. He would rather try to fix things and deal with all that than just ask to be forgiven. Or maybe he doesn't even think forgiveness is an option. So he's walking home, and he knows this is going to happen. He's reciting these words in his head. How's he feeling? How would you feel? So what does the father do? Well, the father runs. I've always thought about, as I've looked at this passage for years and years, I've always thought about this song. I think it was maybe late high school, early college, I heard it, called The Bike Song. And it's by a band called 10th Avenue North. And it's mostly about a dad teaching his son to ride a bike without training wheels. So his son is, I don't know, 7 or 8 or whatever. And so the dad takes him out and he teaches him and he takes the training wheels off and the son is going, he's doing great. He goes through this tunnel, he goes down by the beach, but then he hits a rock and he goes flying and the bike is all messed up. And so he's laying there helpless and hurting, and his clothes are all bloody, right, and torn, and he's embarrassed, and he's a kid, so he doesn't know what to do. And then the song says, but off in the distance, a man starts to run. It was my daddy saving his son. And the more that I cried, the more he embraced, so I rode on his shoulders, and flying back home, we raced. And so here's this son, helpless, penniless, dirty, embarrassed, guilty, hurting, but off in the distance, a man starts to run. Which isn't something that we would expect a father in that culture to do, especially an insulted, rejected patriarch. In fact, in his position and at his age, you always walk slowly and in a dignified manner. You would never run. No one over 25 ran in that culture. But what he does is he hikes up his robes, which shows off his legs in a very humiliating way. If he's wearing robes all the time, they're probably nice and pasty white, or pasty light brown. And he runs, and the word used is the Greek word for foot races in stadiums. So he is sprinting to his son. He's sprinting toward you. Off in the distance, a man starts to run, and he sprints to reconcile his son to himself, but also to save him from public humiliation because he's been watching and waiting. That's how he knows to run. One of my favorite passages in the Bible is found in Isaiah 30, toward the end of Isaiah 30. And God's people have been trying really hard to save themselves. God has told them what to do. They're not listening. They're totally guilty. They're screwing up. They're failing to save themselves. But then it says in verse 18, "Yet the Lord longs to be gracious to you. Therefore, he will rise up to show you compassion." The Lord longs to be gracious to you. This father longed to be gracious to his son. He was just waiting for the chance to do it. And so this cutting off ceremony, right, it's about to happen, but the father runs to get there before it can happen. And these villagers who would have seen the son coming in and would have started to gather, right, to humiliate him and to cut him off, they're distracted by the father and by his humiliation. And so the father takes on for himself the shame and the humiliation that the younger son deserves. God doesn't wait for us to come to him, but at great personal cost, he goes out to seek and save the lost. And so this son must have been really, really scared, but he sees his dad running, and he's shocked at this costly demonstration of his father's love, love that was always there, but he never saw it. And so look at the difference. I think this is fascinating, the difference between what he had planned to ask his dad and what he ends up saying. So in verse 18 and 19, his plan was to say, "Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Treat me as one of your hired servants." But what he actually says after his father runs to him is, "Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son." And that's it. Nothing about being a hired servant. He is so stunned by his father's love that he doesn't offer to be an employee anymore. He doesn't try to be a servant, but he puts himself at his father's mercy. "I'm not worthy. Period. That's it. I can't earn it. I can't fix it. I'm not going to try." He surrenders completely to his father's will. He puts himself totally in his father's hands. He doesn't try to manipulate his father. He doesn't try to fix it or to earn favor. He just confesses and surrenders. He didn't try to save himself, but he accepts that he is lost and that his only chance is for his father to receive him back. And you know, he could have used false humility, right? He could have said, no, "I'm unworthy. Don't forgive me. I'll make it right. I'll be a servant. It's fine." But that would have been trying to save himself. And instead, he has genuine humility where he says, "You're right. I'm unworthy. The only thing I can do is surrender. And I need to accept your love." You know, when we insist to God that he let us fix things, we insist to God that we're not worthy of his love, that's false humility. That's all it is. We're just trying to save ourselves. Brothers and sisters, you are not servants. You are sons and daughters. And when you screw up, when you do that thing that you can't believe you did for the millionth time, when you reject God, when you spit in his face, when you ruin his plans, when you humiliate him, you're not a servant. You don't have to try to make things right. You don't have to balance the scales. You don't have to earn his favor. You simply confess and surrender and put yourself at his mercy, because in Jesus, you are his child, and he is a really good father. You're not a servant. And so the father sends his servants out, the actual servants out, to bring some things back to the son. And so he gets the best robe. And so the best robe, by wearing it, it would signify to the whole village that he's been restored back into the family. And he gets the signet ring, which would tell everyone he has now the authority of his father. So they really trust him. And he gets shoes, which means, first of all, he was barefoot, so he's not bringing much to the table. But in that culture, slaves were barefoot and sons wore shoes. He is fully restored. And so what the father does is amazing to me. He doesn't just restore his relationship with the son. He restores the son's relationship with every part of the village. The villagers would see him be publicly received, and they would know there's no cutting off. There's no rejection here. The servants are ordered to come and clothe him, so they would know, we got to treat this guy with respect. He's back part of the family. And at the party, when he's wearing the robe and he has a signet ring, the elders of the village would accept him. They would respect him out of their loyalty to the father. So he's restored back to everybody, and the only person that could do that was his father. His hard work couldn't do that. Only the father, and only through grace. The younger son literally brings nothing to the table but filthy rags. You know, the Pharisees and the scribes in verses 1 and 2, they were complaining that Jesus accepted and ate with sinners. And Jesus doesn't apologize for that. He doesn't act like, yeah, I'm just throwing them a bone, I'm just pitying them. No, he actually takes it one step further. He says, you think that I just eat with them? No. I run to rescue them with open arms, and I throw a party when they accept my grace. So what about the older son? As we come to the end, what does he do? Well, he hears music and dancing. There's a big party going on. Guests have already arrived. So what would you think? Well, you would expect him to just go right in. Or maybe go in to wash up, right, and then go to the party. But what does he do instead? Well, he's suspicious, and he's aloof, because there's some problems here. And so he calls the servant. Hey, what's going on in there? And the servant tells him, and if you look at the verse, at the end of verse 27, our English translation says that the father received his son back safe and sound. This is a Greek word, hygienio, and in ordinary Greek usage, this has to do with good health. It's where our word hygiene comes from. But in the Greek Old Testament, this word is used 11 times, and every single time it's in reference to the biblical concept of shalom, which is peace and restoration. And so what's being said is not that he received him back healthy, but the father received him back with peace, with reconciliation. So they expected this ceremony of rejection, and what they got was a party of reconciliation. And notice why the servant says they're having a party. He says, your father has killed the fattened calf because he, the father, has received him back, hygienio, with peace. The key is not that the son came back. The key is that the father received him. The party is in honor of the father. The party is in honor of the father's success in creating shalom. But the older brother is furious. If he had been told, your brother's back, safe and sound, he's healthy, but we haven't decided, you know, is he going to be punished or is he going to be forgiven? What are we going to do with him? We're not really sure, but he's healthy. I think he would have gone running right in because he would want to shout, don't forgive him. I mean, think about all the things he's going to say in a couple verses. This son of yours, right? He was out there doing all this terrible stuff. He would run right in to add his voice. But instead, he's told that there's already reconciliation between the father and his brother, and so he's furious. And so again, we go back to the cultural expectations. Well, he's the oldest son, which means not only as a member, male member of the family where you would go in and you'd greet all the guests, but as the oldest son, he would be expected to be the head waiter. And so he would go and he would serve his dad, he would serve the guests, he would serve the guest of honor, which is his brother, and he doesn't want to do that. Maybe because he thinks he's above it. Maybe because he can't bring himself to serve his younger brother. Maybe because he thinks his father has dishonored the family by showing grace. But, you know, we're at this party, and it's really obvious really fast that the head waiter and the older brother doesn't show up. So everybody knows. Everybody knows that he's not coming. He's throwing a little teenage temper tantrum, right? He won't come into the party. And here's the father who just got back the other son who had publicly humiliated him. And now this older son is doing the same thing. And I don't know what would have happened to you, you know, if your parents were throwing a big party and you were a teenager and you decided you weren't going to come out of your room or something, right? Well, I don't know what would have happened to you, but probably one of two things. I would guess either your parents would have just ignored you, let you stay in your room and deal with you later, right? And they're just going to have their party, or they're going to go punish you and get you downstairs, right? But the father doesn't do either of those. He goes to reconcile, not to punish, not to ignore. Which would have been, again, very humiliating for him. He's the host of this party. You don't leave your own party, but he does. He's willing to endure shame and be self-sacrificial in love to go after his son. And so he goes out in verse 28 to entreat with him, to plead with him. Come on, come into the party. Come in, reconcile with your brother. But the older brother doesn't want to. He doesn't want to make any effort in reconciliation. He doesn't want to listen to his dad. He thinks it's all about the law. Well, I never disobeyed your command. But he ignores that there's brokenness in their relationship. He accuses his father of favoritism. Wait a minute, when am I going to get my party? He despises his brother so much that he won't even call him his brother. He says, this son of yours. He's consumed with self-righteousness, with bitterness, with anger, with sarcasm, with envy. And he thinks that he's the one being wronged. He thinks that he's the one that deserves an apology. And ultimately, he's just like his brother because he sees this relationship not as father and son, but servant and master. Look what he says in verse 27. Look, these many years I have served. I'm sorry, that's not verse 27. But anyway, look, these many years I have served you, and I never disobeyed your command. Yet you never gave me a young goat so that I might celebrate with my friends. The New International Version translates the first part of this: look, all these years I have been slaving for you. I worked so hard. I never did anything wrong. He doesn't deserve any mercy. I deserve to be celebrated. I'm the good one, right? I'm the one that stayed. You don't deserve to be honored for creating peace with him. You deserve to be humiliated because you've been holding out on me. When do I get mine? He wants to be a servant. He doesn't want to be a son. And he wants to get what he thinks he deserves. And all of that, and the father goes out to him anyway. There is no evidence that he's going to apologize. There's no evidence that he is the least bit repentant or even aware of what he's done wrong. He thinks he's doing all the right things, but he's living exactly like a servant. He's rejecting his father. He's trying to earn his way. He's trying to be independent, and he doesn't really want his father's love. He just wants his father's stuff. He's just as lost as his younger brother. He's just as much of a prodigal as his younger brother. And, you know, for years when I read this story, I would think of this story as the story of the bad, rebellious younger son, and then the mostly good, hardworking, but maybe, you know, has a few problems, older son. And of course, I was the older son, so I felt pretty good about that, right? Just a few problems. But neither of these sons are good. Neither of them deserve forgiveness. Both of them, in their own ways, are rejecting being part of the family. Both, in their own ways, are saying, let me save myself. So this, then, is the brotherhood of believers. They're not good people and bad people, good Christians and bad Christians, good sons and bad sons. They're just people in need of mercy, some of whom choose to live like servants and try to save themselves, and some of whom choose to live like sons and daughters and surrender to the mercy of the Father. And so our job as the church is not to condemn one another, it's not to critique people, it's to encourage one another, even and especially in our failures and in our sins, to live like sons and daughters, to not fall back into the pattern of trying to earn God's favor and make things right, but to remember that in Jesus, who took the ultimate pain and humiliation on our behalf, we are beloved and forgiven and free. So Jesus famously leaves this story unfinished, and he's talking to religious people who might have said, like the older son said, all these years I've served you, God, and I've never disobeyed your command. These Pharisees and scribes who want no part of those bad prodigals, those tax collectors and sinners, that bad younger son. He leaves the story unfinished. And so the question hangs in the air. Will they be reconciled to the Father? Will they let go of their self-righteousness and stop trying to save themselves? Will they have the genuine humility to accept his love? Will you stop trying to be a servant and stop trying to save yourself and let God forgive you? Will they be reconciled to the Father? Will you? Let me pray. God, we deserve nothing from you. Each of us, including me, reject you in our own ways, and we try to save ourselves. We are so self-reliant. And yet you, in your incredible mercy, are willing to endure incredible pain and suffering that you don't deserve, humiliation you don't deserve, death on a cross that Jesus did not deserve, in order that we might be restored to you. And I thank you. I thank you that you don't wait for us to come to you, but you run to us. I thank you that you don't wait for us to fix things on our own strength because we can't, but you long to be gracious to us. I thank you for this beautiful story of your love, and I thank you that it's true. And I pray for the men and women here. I pray that if there are those who have maybe never received your mercy, have maybe never felt like they were free to stop trying to save themselves, that they were free to just surrender and be loved and forgiven, I pray that for the first time they would experience that with you, that they would cast their cares on you and know that you're a good Father and in Jesus they can be forgiven. And I pray for those of us who have known you a long time but slip back so often into living like servants, and maybe even into being self-righteous. I know I do. I pray that you would teach us again and again to live as sons and daughters. We are beloved. We don't have to work to earn your favor. Jesus has earned it all. And we don't have to look down on other people because we're all the same. We need your mercy, and you freely offer it to us. So we worship you, God, and I pray that you would receive these songs we're about to sing as worship, as a fragrant offering. We don't deserve to come into your presence, but you run to throw your best robe around us, to put your signet ring on our fingers and shoes on our feet. And so we worship you. In Jesus' name, amen.